Well, boy, it's a political odd couple for all time. Dwight Eisenhower was so many things that Richard Nixon was not. Ike seemed warm, spontaneous, and honest. A war hero, he breezed into the White House the first time he sought the job. Nixon was disliked, and he knew it. Even Eisenhower wondered if Nixon was ready to be president. He was Tricky Dick and was almost dumped from the ticket both in 1952 and again in 1956. Nixon, of course, lost the White House in 1960, only to win it 8 years later. He wound up serving as Ike's vice president for all 8 years, even though a simmering level of discomfort existed between them. Jeffrey Frank has a new book out on the relationship, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. He is a former senior editor at The New Yorker and deputy editor of the Washington Post Outlook section. He speaks in town tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Jeff, so good to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
Well, they were men of different generations. Ike's from Kansas. Nixon is from Southern California. Ike was this towering figure. Nixon was this guy struggling to find his way. So why did Eisenhower pick Dick Nixon to be his running mate in 1952?
Yeah, and I'm going to talk a lot more about it tonight, but Eisenhower didn't really pick Nixon. He was his advisors were very much in favor of Nixon, and one of his chief advisors was Tom Dewey, who was then the governor of New York and had run for president twice.
And lost to Harry Truman in 48, obviously.
Very famously. And so Eisenhower chose him. He'd met Nixon only once before at a lunch at the Bohemian Grove in 1950. And Eisenhower, I don't think, remembered the encounter. Nixon sure did.
So Eisenhower hardly knew Dick Nixon when he brought him aboard as his running mate.
Right. And he knew of him, and he was happy that he was glad to know that Nixon supported the Marshall Plan. Eisenhower was a real internationalist, and so that was important. But his advisors saw Nixon very valuable because for a couple of reasons. He was a Westerner, he was young, and he was a very, very good anti-communist. He was a red hunter.
Yeah, and that was hot back in those days,
very
right?
Very hot. Yeah, Joe McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, had reached his zenith in February of 1950 when he found a list of communists. An alleged list of communists in the State Department. But Nixon was riding that horse before McCarthy and kept on with it.
But it wasn't long after Eisenhower names Nixon to be his running mate that Nixon almost gets dumped off the ticket in 52, would have ended his political career. What happened?
Yeah, I mean that was a very rough moment for Nixon. One of the campaign slogans that the ticket had was "Let's clean house with Ike and Dick." And by that, the house they wanted to clean was the mess they saw that Harry Truman was leaving.
Cronyism and all that stuff that they thought was going on in the White House.
Mink coats given to stenographers, 5% kickbacks. That was all part of the language. So suddenly, the New York Post has a story saying a secret Nixon fund. And it wasn't so secret, and it wasn't, and it was actually more of a smear than a real story. But it sure was embarrassing to Eisenhower at the ticket, and Eisenhower was so embarrassed by it and so annoyed by it, he wanted to get rid of Nixon.
So that leads to Dick Nixon giving his famous checker speech. We're going to listen to that in just a moment here. What was that
lucky us.
Yes. What was that speech about, and why was it named the checker speech, Jeff?
Well, it was basically Nixon's one chance to clear himself, to explain to the country which was following this with great interest. The press was fascinated by this story. So it was Nixon's one chance to sort of clear himself of charges that he was enthralled to the secret group of California millionaires. Checkers was by the way, the fund was amounted to either $16,000 or $18,000. So it was by today's standards, it was a lot of money. And Checkers came out of Nixon said toward the end of the speech, he said, "Well, a friend or a donor in Texas sent a package to us, and it was a black and white Cocker Spaniel, and Tricia fell in love with it immediately and called it Checkers. And by gosh, we're not going to give it back."
So he's defending.
I don't have that word for word.
He's going through his assets and saying, "By George, you know, there are some things we're not rich people. We're going to keep the dog, and therefore." The speech got the checkers' names attached to it.
Right, and it was an excruciating speech for Mrs. Nixon, who had to hear her husband talking about their debts, the mortgages, all of it, and so on. And
Let's listen to a little bit of Richard Nixon's checker speech from 1952.
One other thing I probably should tell you because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me, too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
That's Dick Nixon trying to milk just a little bit of sympathy from the American public. Do I have that right, Jeff?
Yeah, and also a way to sort of let the Democrats know that he'd heard Franklin Roosevelt's famous speech in which he invoked his dog Fala. So Nixon was a very calculated thing. Nixon never referred to it himself. It was the fund speech, the fund episode, and he never got over it. By the way, Julie Nixon wrote later on and said every year he would turn to his family and say, "You know what today is? It's the anniversary of the fun speech." And his wife Pat said it was a scar that never healed.
Jeff Frank is our guest. His new book, Ike and Dick: Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. In it, yes, it was very strange. Jeff Frank speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza, the Plaza Branch. More information, kclibrary.org. Well, Eisenhower, Jeff, almost dumped Dick Nixon from the ticket again 4 years later. You're 4 years into his administration at that point. What was that one about?
Yeah, I mean that was very different. Dumping was probably not quite the word for it, and we're not going to have time. It's really, really interesting, sort of a really interesting passive aggressive dance that went on between them for months, which I'll go into tonight. But yeah, Eisenhower had a heart attack 6 months earlier, and he was already beginning to sense his own mortality, and he wanted someone else for vice president. He actually had a name. He wanted a man named Bob Anderson, Robert Anderson, who had been the Deputy Secretary of the Navy, and Eisenhower had what one you can only think of as a man crush on him, and he offered, but he wasn't going to dump Nixon this time. He said, "Well, Dick, I think you ought to have some managerial experience, so why don't you?" And he offered cabinet posts, particularly Secretary of Defense. Nixon himself, being a very smart politician, said he knew it would be perceived as if he were being dumped, and that was so.
And at that point in their relationship, Jeff, what is Eisenhower's issue with Dick Nixon? Why is he thinking in those terms that he wants to perhaps remove him as his vice president?
That's really unclear. And I talked to David Eisenhower about this too. And I said,
"What a great guy he is!
Yeah,
he has ties to the Kansas, you know, still to this day." And
oh, terrific! Yeah. And actually, one of the most satisfying. I had to do 70 interviews for this book, and getting Julie Nixon and David Eisenhower to talk to me, it took me a year and a half. But they're terrific. They were terrific and so smart. Someone once said to me that Julie would be governor of Pennsylvania had it not been for her father's problems later on.
Wow.
And so on.
Wow.
So but I asked about that. It's hard to tell whether Eisenhower was sincere about it and really wanted Nixon. He really did think that the vice presidency was kind of a nothing job, and that Nixon. Mm-hmm. And that if Nixon ever had more ambitions, he should have this experience. But the other thing is, he didn't. I can never say that he disliked Nixon. I've always come down to something that his advisor, one advisor said to him that he was not fond of Nixon. And Bryce Harlow was
sure.
And who said it. And I think that's probably closer to it. That's not the same as dislike.
Yeah. So that discomfort would have stemmed from what? What a great word!
They couldn't have been less alike. I mean, I think that's partly it. I mean, here you, and I think that Eisenhower basically regarded everyone except for a few close friends, some of his golfing buddies and his army friends, as staff. Nixon was staff, and staff doesn't become president. And so he was replaceable. And I think that was simply it. And he wanted other people. And as I say, I've got a fascinating conversation in the Oval Office that Eisenhower's executive secretary, Ann Whitman, dutifully wrote down, and they're quite interesting. Just sort of a day-to-day, minute-by-minute record of scheming to get rid of somebody.
Right, and Eisenhower scheming to get rid of Nixon in this case.
And then Nixon, of course, hanging on. Nixon had sensed, even during the Checkers episode, that the five-star general, the commander of the Allied armies, was not tremendously good when it came to hand-to-hand combat in politics, American politics.
Yeah, so Nixon's whole plan here throughout the 8 years of Eisenhower's administration is simply to survive it, to live to fight another day politically, perhaps to go for the White House himself.
Yeah, I don't think he saw the White House. I mean, I'm sure that was always in the back of his mind in some way. But that didn't become clear to him until Eisenhower had this heart attack in 1955. And I think that also, as I say, then became 1956, then suddenly became a different kind of election. People began to see people that first thought Eisenhower would never run again. And then secondly, people were saying that he might not survive. Adlai Stevenson, who ran against Ike twice and lost twice, in his election eve speech in 1956, he said, I hate to say this, but I think the odds are Eisenhower's not going to live, and Dick Nixon's going to be president.
The country had just gone through a president dying in office just 10 or 11 years earlier when Franklin Roosevelt died and Harry Truman took over. So that idea of a president dying in office certainly wasn't lost on anybody.
Exactly. And that had come as a huge shock to the country. And Eisenhower, when he ran in 56, had been ill. He had an ileitis episode, which was quite serious. And then in the fall of 57, he had a minor stroke, which was very, very alarming to a lot of people, particularly Eisenhower.
If our listeners want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @kcuruptodate. You know, we're visiting again with Jeff Frank, his new book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. When Eisenhower suffered his health problems in 55, heading into 56, to what extent did Nixon ever assume the presidency himself? And how were Eisenhower's aides, how comfortable were they with Dick Nixon potentially taking over the presidency?
Yeah, there again, that was a really interesting and often awkward situation. There were moments of absolute panic among some of Eisenhower's advisors, who was in charge and so on.
Whether they were in charge?
John Foster Dulles. John Foster Dulles was actually alive, and he had an uncle who was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State. And when Wilson had his stroke, and basically no one was running the government, Dulles had immediately asked for research on that period and so on. Nixon never ran the government. Nixon stepped in to do the duties of the vice president. And that was actually one of his finest hours. Even people who didn't like Nixon, and there were a lot of people who didn't like Nixon then, thought he behaved very well. He was very discreet. He never asserted himself. Eisenhower had given him certain duties while he was president, and to chair, for example, to chair the cabinet in his absence, and Nixon did that. And there was a lot of sort of territorial jealousy, but not so much from Nixon, more from Foster Dulles.
So Nixon sort of moved in quietly and handled some duties as president, but nothing remarkable, it doesn't sound like.
Nothing remarkable at all. Nothing that would have upset Eisenhower at the time. He really did the duties of a vice president, and he obviously made no major decisions. Mm-hmm. And Eisenhower was pretty soon was well enough to if there had been a major decision. They would have eventually consulted Eisenhower. They were lucky. It was a very quiet time then.
Yeah, and so again, Nixon just sort of weathers these vice presidential years, thinking that at some point he'll have a shot at the White House himself.
Yeah, and there's more than that too. The heart attack really did change. Really was a defining moment, to use that cliche. Suddenly the people were really discussing Nixon in terms of being an heir to the presidency. And that wasn't – people did not think of vice presidents as heirs to the presidency. Certainly Roosevelt, who had three of them, never thought any of them were heirs to the presidency, as you well know. Harry Truman, they'd met before because Truman was a senator from Missouri. But they after Roosevelt was elected in 1944 with Truman, they had one lunch together. It was photographed, and they never saw each other again. Then Roosevelt died.
But it sounds like Nixon was much more involved in the administration, at least of Eisenhower, than his predecessors in the vice presidential office had been prior.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Eisenhower was very conscious of how ill-informed Truman was. He was alarmed that Truman did not even know about the atomic bomb. So even though Nixon was sort of not brought into the inner circle, he was certainly there for all the National Security Council meetings, the cabinet meetings, the meetings with legislative leaders. Eisenhower also sent Nixon on a sort of big around the world trip in the fall of 1953. So he really wanted Nixon to sort of at least get the job. And if were anything to happen to him, Nixon at least would at least know what was going on.
You know, Jeff, it's probably fair to say at this point that any idea that folks have of Eisenhower being this affable, easy-to-get-along guy, that at least he's viewed by many folks today looking back as, you know, he's smiling and friendly. He wasn't that way really at all. He was a difficult guy to work for, if I understand correctly.
Sure he was. And he had a temper. And he was not affable and fun in private. I take that. I mean, when he was playing golf at Burning Tree, well, actually, even there, he could certainly lose his temper. No, he wasn't. He was a beloved figure, and more beloved by Americans than anyone we've had since. But he was sort of a chilly guy in private.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
So we got this email from Scott at UpToDate@KCUR.org. He writes to ask, Ike's secretary, Lillian Brown, nicknamed Rusty, is still living, he says. She lived in Kansas City, Kansas for a long time. Now she lives in Virginia. Did you ever interview her?
No, I didn't. The person who was in on everything was Ann Whitman. Who died? I think 15 years ago, and she was remarkable. If you go to Abilene and read the Ann Whitman diaries, you'll just it's like a revelation. She had a sense of herself and history, and I quote from it great length as any biographer of Eisenhower would do.
You would have liked to have talked to her.
Oh, I would have loved to. I'd love to.
Yeah.
She took him on too. She would say things. I mean, she got annoyed at him, and she could speak back to him.
Let's move ahead to the election of 1960, Jeff, because, again, a pivotal moment, Nixon versus Kennedy. Kennedy winds up winning by a whisker, and a lot of people thought the results would have been different if it had been for something that Eisenhower said about Nixon during that crucial fall campaign. What did Eisenhower say, and how did Nixon react to it?
Well, that was
what a moment.
Well, it came in the midst of a really sort of these strange late summer press conferences, and they were asking Eisenhower the questions went all over the place, including asking him, I think, was one question about Potsdam, and actually Eisenhower said some very nice things about Nixon. But then someone asked, well, can you think of one major idea he's contributed? And Eisenhower said, well, if you give me a week, I'll think of one, and that was just devastating. People, the reporters,
man.
That was the last question. The reporters laughed and. You could hear them laughing, and that was the end of it. And that haunted Nixon that year. And Jack Kennedy used it in his own campaign ads. And many years after, it never went away, actually.
Did Eisenhower try to sort of take that back and swallow it after he said it, or not really?
It took him some time to say something nice about Nixon. He really he said privately, "Oh, I wish I'd never said that." And he told Nixon says that he called and said he was being facetious. Eisenhower certainly wanted Nixon to win that election. He had total contempt for Jack Kennedy. He thought he was an upstart and totally out of his depth. But that was Ike, and he didn't. I don't think he quite realized at first the effect he'd had. And as I say, it took him a month to get back. Nixon had to go on the Jack Parr show, which was the precursor to the Johnny Carson show, to explain himself, to explain what he thought Eisenhower meant. It was devastating. That wasn't the reason he lost. He lost for many other reasons, too.
Sure, but it sure didn't help.
It sure didn't help.
Yeah. Again, fast-forwarding through their relationship, Eisenhower dies in early 1969, Jeff, just weeks after Nixon had assumed the presidency. Did Eisenhower ever develop any respect for his old vice president? How did the two wind up together at the end?
Well, I would think in some ways Eisenhower always had respect for him, which is not the same thing as having great affection for him. And one of the things that appealed to me in writing this book was the narrative arc of it, the fact that they ended up, these two men who didn't even know each other in 1952, ended up as family. And that was one of the things that ended later on. I mentioned Julie Nixon and David Eisenhower, and they began dating in 1966, when they were 18 years old.
And the general, the president, didn't like the idea of his grandson, David Eisenhower, becoming engaged to Julie Nixon, right?
No, he liked Julie. Everyone liked Julie. But he wanted David. He just wanted David to, you know, you should go to medical school, you should go to law school. And he gave David a tough time. Mamie Eisenhower reminded Ike that they were married, that she was 19 years old when she married him. So knock it off. And they did get married. They got married a month after the 1968 election. And yeah, things changed between them. They were family. They had Thanksgiving together.
I was going to say, how did that change thing? When you become family like that, how did that affect their relationship?
One person who knew them all told me that, and as I say, Eisenhower never had much affection for Nixon, but that Julie, actually they blamed it on Julie, that anybody who could produce a daughter as nice as Julie can't be all bad. That was why someone put it to me, and that was for real. And so Eisenhower did have respect for him, but he didn't like him, or didn't much like him. And I think that kind of sums it up. And at the end, I mean, Nixon was very dutiful. He went to visit Eisenhower on his deathbed at Walter Reed. He really always wanted Eisenhower to approve of him, and that meant a lot to him.
And it never really quite happened the way he would have liked to have it happen.
No, in the book I go into a scene between them that clearly Nixon imagined, but I quote it because it's just it's so unbelievable. But that's Nixon really wanted it to be true.
Jeff Frank speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza Branch. More information, just go to kclibrary.org. Jeff Frank's new book is Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. It's gotten great reviews. Jeff, thanks so much for your time today. So good to have you.
Thank you, Steve. I really enjoyed being here.
Enjoy your time here. You bet. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. For KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.